Welcome to a Moray House Trust podcast. Moray House Trust is a private non-profit based in Georgetown and dedicated to promoting Guyanese culture. This podcast is part of our 1763 series. We hope you enjoy it.
The following extract from the book Blood of the River, a chronicle of mutiny and freedom on the wild coast by Marjolaine Kars, is being presented with the kind permission of the author and is read by Russell Lancaster. Chapter 4, Governing. For at least a year, if not more, rebellion had been in the air. Some enslaved people contemplated starting their own maroon settlements in the bush. But at some point, the conversation turned. Rather than leave themselves, why not force the Dutch to do the leaving? Instead of doing the back-breaking work of starting new farms in the jungle, they could take over the plantations where they lived. The uprising that broke out at the end of February 1763 centered on several adjoining plantations in the heart of the colony. But the speed with which the rebels expanded their uprising suggests not only widely shared discontent, but also the existence of political organization of some sort. Signs indicate elements of self-government, with a leadership likely drawn from men and some women who were powerful on their plantations before the rebellion. The head of the Berbice uprising was Kofij van Lilienberg, who lived on the plantation of the Barkie family. Lilienberg was a mid-sized estate with 40 slaves. Kofij identified as Amina, a term the Dutch used for people who had been captured on the Gold Coast of Africa, present-day Ghana. The English used the term Coromanti, or Cromanti. The name Kofi, rendered as Kofij in Dutch, is a common Akan name given to Gold Coast boys born on a Friday. No first-hand testimony survives from Kofij. Many people the Dutch questioned as the rebellion wound down mentioned Kofij, but unfortunately they provided few personal details. We do not know, for instance, how old he was or whether he was a husband or father. Did his face bear the scarification tattoos, three parallel lines from ear to eye, typical of the West African Akan, to indicate status, family and birthplace? The Dutch records rarely remark on physical attributes and never mention filed teeth or facial and body scarification, though many Africans in Berbice carried such country marks. Perhaps Kofij was stolen from his parents before he received his. Kofij was a man of broad experience. A contemporary claimed that he was brought to Berbice as a child. Two enslaved women reported crossing the Atlantic with him. He grew up on the plantation of one of the most hated planters in the colony, experiencing firsthand the worst brutality of Dutch rule. He was initially trained as a house servant in the Barkie family and later became a cooper. His trajectory made him a highly assimilated or creolized African, familiar with the ways of whites. He must have been highly charismatic and spiritually forceful, as Akan people from the Gold Coast prized such qualities in their political leaders. He was chosen as the commander, one insurgent later claimed, because he was a wise and sensible man. Even a planter admiringly called him a man of courage and judgment. Kofij was also a man of vision, eager to secure freedom from chattel slavery for himself and his followers, with bold ideas about the shape of post-emancipation life. His second in command, Akara, also claimed Amina membership and lived on Lilienberg, where he had a wife and at least one grown daughter. Kofij and Akara's identities as Amina matter. Enslaved Africans in the Americas created strong ties where they lived and worked. Europeans and slaves alike identified people by the name of their plantation. Kofij van of Lilienberg, But people developed ties not just to the estates where they were incarcerated. More so than in North America, many African-descended people in the Caribbean and South America also identified across plantations with members of what Europeans referred to as nations. Nations were fluid communities of people who came from the same general geographic area and who could communicate because they spoke the same or similar languages. In Dutch colonies, Amina or Elmina referred to Akan and Ga speakers from the Gold Coast and its hinterland. In Africa, they would not have considered themselves one nation, as they would have belonged to different ethnicities and political communities. Nations were American cultural creations for social and religious fellowship. Creoles might or might not claim national membership. Which facet of one's identity took precedence? Plantation, nation, or Creole status? And what the affiliation meant at any given time depended on circumstances. The rebellion, as war tends to do, politicized such difficult choices. The sources shed little light on the planning of the rebellion. The Dutch did not ask about it in their judicial processes, so people did not speak of it much. One can piece together clues to get a picture of the organization. People strategized first on their individual plantations and next across estates through membership in nations. This was especially true of the Amina. The Amina were not only one of many nations in Berbice, but they were a sizable and coherent group. The Dutch bought many slaves on the West African Gold Coast, especially after a series of wars there in the 1730s transformed large numbers of people into prisoners of war. Male Amina tended to be well-schooled in statecraft and military affairs. They came from hierarchical cultures in which people avidly sought avenues for social advancement, notably through the ownership of slaves. They were behind many rebellions in the Americas, on the Danish island of St. John in 1733, and in British Jamaica in 1760. Time and again, black Berbicians, questioned by the Dutch as the rebellion wound down, pointed to the Amina as instigators. Africans of many nations, as well as some Creoles, participated in the uprising, but the Amina formed the senior leadership. In the first days and weeks of the uprising, the rebels worked to convince or coerce as many people as possible to rise up and do so quickly before the Europeans had a chance to mobilize. Bombers played a crucial role in getting people on board. Depending on whether they behaved like junior managers or shop stewards, bombers were resented or respected. Their moral authority could sway people to join, resist, or dodge the insurgents. Moreover, many fleeing planters had left their plantations in the care of their bombers, handing over keys and guns. This access made them doubly useful to the rebels. The judicial interrogations the Dutch conducted in 1764 suggest that when insurgents arrived on a plantation, they moved quickly to gain support and defuse opposition. They searched for weapons and powder and confiscated guns left by Europeans in the hands of trusted slaves. They tied up resistors. They assessed the leanings of the bomber or bombers, as larger plantations had more than one. Those who refused to join the rebellion were threatened, along with their family members. If that failed, they were whipped or even killed. The bomber at Plantation La Providence was flogged by the rebels. Bomber Fortuyn van Lilienburg and Louis, bomber at Hoogstraten, two plantations at the heart of the rebellion, were murdered. Rebelling slaves in Saint-Domingue, present-day Haiti, some 25 years later, acted similarly towards commandeurs, as bombers were known in French. The large number of bombers among the Burmese rebels suggest that many decided to join or had been in on the planning. They played a similar leading role in Saint-Domingue's massive uprising in 1791. Once the rebels took care of opposition, they raided the plantations. They slaughtered fowl and livestock and roasted them on spits. They helped themselves to wine and liquor. They broke into chests and cupboards, shed their rags and dressed in their enslavers' finest. Some leaders, in significant gestures of social inversion, dined with their families in great style at the tables of the very men and women who had kept them hungry. When the rebels did not want to keep a plantation in production, they torched crops and buildings, making European return difficult. To prevent non-rebellious slaves from staying on their plantation or to punish them for refusing to join, they burned their huts and gardens as well. Rebels urged, or if necessary forced, women along as wives and men as soldiers. Then they sent tent boats and canoes with plunder, captives, and volunteers to rebel headquarters and moved on to the next estate. This was an extract from the book Blood of the River, a chronicle of mutiny and freedom on the Wild Coast by Marjolaine Kars. It was read by Russell Lancaster.
This was a Moray House Trust podcast. Thank you very much for listening.